Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today, we interview Dr. Charlotte Fett, Associate Professor of History at Osceano College in sunny Southern California, about her UNC Press published book in 2017 called Recaptured Africans, Surviving Slave Ships, Detention, and Dislocation in the Final Years of the Slave Trade. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate you having me on. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. And once again, on behalf of New Books in African American Studies, as part of the New Books Network, we definitely thank you for taking the time out. You know, it's snowing out here briefly. I don't know what this is outside in this cold area of Boston, but it's definitely not beautiful Southern California. So we definitely appreciate your time this morning for you and this afternoon for myself.
All right. Thank you.
Can you please tell us about kind of your trajectory as a scholar? How did you begin your work as a historian?
Yes. Well, mine is a little bit of a winding path. I share some commonalities with you in school teaching, in that, as you said, I'm now a professor of history at Occidental College, which is a liberal arts college near downtown Los Angeles. But I was actually a biology major. It took me some time to figure out what I really wanted to do with my life. And I spent 2 years in Washington, D.C. teaching high school science. I was actually a chemistry teacher. And after realizing that this wasn't really my calling, I had to work my way back through a master's degree at Stanford in the School of Education, where I actually did a master's thesis on those northern school teachers who went to Port Royal and kind of black and white women from the north with freedmen's education. And then I applied and got into the PhD program at Rutgers. So I'm very grateful to all my Rutgers mentors, including Suzanne Lebsack and Deborah Gray White and Jerry Grob in History of Medicine, for kind of giving me a chance. So I would say that another personal detail for me, I think, that's influential in my interest in U.S.-Congo relations is that I spent my preteen years in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the decade immediately after independence. So in a kind of post-colonial or maybe neo-colonial setting, and then returned to the United States when I was like 7 or 8 for the first time. Not that I was born there, but that was the first time I was conscious of the United States. So I kind of came into the U.S. as a child of white expat missionaries experiencing the United States and in its civil rights and all social movements turmoil. And so, that gave me a certain perspective and an interest in the Atlantic world and in U.S.-Africa relations. And then I would also say that those things influenced my choice of dissertation subject at Rutgers on African American health and healing. I wrote my first book, Working Cures, looking at healing relations as arenas of creativity and struggle and resistance, and emphasizing especially the doctoring work of enslaved women on the southeastern plantations of the 19th century. But when I turned to the research for this next project, I really had to broaden my scope considerably to a much more Atlantic-wide story.
You know, I was recently out at Brandeis University for the third annual African-American Intellectual History Society's conference. And one thing was for certain, everybody either went to Howard or they went to Rutgers or taught at Rutgers. So, you know, it's very much not, you know, we had a lot of conversations actually on that, specific to people like Deborah Gray White, you know, phenomenal historian, you know, and I, a woman, a plantation South, you know, along with folks, you know, you've had David Levering Lewis there. You've had Jennifer Morgan. You've had so many great scholars come through there as students, but also as professors. And you can see in the phenomenal work that, you know, students like yourself, well, students formerly and presently as professors, have done in the academy in the last really 25 to 30 years. So that's really kudos to you and everyone who comes out of that program. So, and you see, like I said, in the work.
Yes, it was really and became, after I left, continued to be a place where I think a lot of the Atlantic world scholarship was a center there, and women's history, African American history, just a wonderful place. And then being so close to being right in that near New York, near Princeton, a lot of collaboration. And even with Princeton, we had reciprocal, we were able to take classes. So I was able to take a class with Nell Painter when she had newly arrived at Princeton, you know, in a graduate seminar of six students with her. So that was it was a real privilege for me to have that graduate school experience.
That's saying something, because, you know, New Jersey is seen as like the stepchild to New York as far as most other things. But when it comes to historians, I'd like to say that they've come out very much on their own and show New York what they got, you know, cooking over there in Princeton, and also, I guess, New Brunswick, New Jersey as well. And so specifically getting into the book, one of the things that I really enjoyed about this book was that you start to learn more and more that, you know, you have these particular narratives about the starting and the ending of certain institutions and certain things in history, and specifically about, in this case, the slave trade, right? And how, you know, I've had Shawande Musakim on the show in late 2017, and now having yourself on here, and you're really seeing a lot of, you know, a lot more studies in the last few years specific about the slave trade that builds on people like Marcus Schrediger Stephanie Smallwood as well, and others. But the great thing is you're starting to learn more that a lot of these systems did not end. You know, they continued well past their supposed expiration date. That no, it was very much poisonous well after that date, and it kept on going.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, there are a couple things there. One is that we use this magical date of 1807, 1808, depending on the bill passed, bill effective, for the U.S. and Britain abolishing the slave trade. But there were many countries that, or colonial settings, where the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French, where the slave trade continued to be legal long after that. So it's not like, even in terms of the law, everything shifted in 1807 or 1808. So that's one thing. And then the other is, even after it became illegal, throughout all of the slaving European colonies and nations, the trade continued as an illegal traffic in human beings. That's what my book deals with. But, you know, I have the figure that if you look at the very latest ban on the slave trade, so when all abolition bans had been passed around 1836 or so, there are 1.3 million Africans who are still enslaved, even after that, up till the last known slaving journey being 1866. And then we're not even counting the other kinds of bonded and forced labor that kick in and develop, like the coolie trade from Asia, from China and India. So this is a long and complicated history in the 19th century.
Right. And you know, I think about the work of David Eltis and folks with the they have the online database. Right. And I think that, you know, especially when it comes to teaching the slave trade and teaching about what, you know, the trade actually meant in bodies and also in, you know, insurance and in all these different capacities. It's why I think it's still a place that, you know, it's a vibrant area of study for important reasons. And I think that also what you do is that because your work is specific to the time frame after the slave trade was supposed to have ended with the British and the U.S. Involvement in it, that it goes to show that, you know, when you look at work like the Amistad and others, there were other cases that were Amistad-like or that were specifically just different than what happened with the Amistad with particular differences. But it goes to show that in legal limbo, in a space where, you know, Black folks, you know, antebellum Northern Black folks were not free in the sense that, you know, you look at the work of Elizabeth Studer Pryor at Smith and her work about the mobility of colored travelers, it showed that, you know, even those folks were not truly free. So what would have happened to people who come from Africa after the slave trade? Like, what is their legal status? And I think that's one of the cool parts about your book, is that you kind of get to see, not kind of, you absolutely explicitly get to see, you know, what their statuses were in the United States.
Yes. Boy, you said so many things there that I want to respond to. I want to go back to the digital humanities issue and the Voyages database. And because that collaborative work that developed over two decades or more has really changed what we're able to know from the macro level down to the individual ship and individual person level. And then in the field of recaptured Africans or liberated Africans, I'd like to talk about that terminology a little bit too before we go very much farther. But in terms of that, there is a whole digital humanities project that I'm part of in a minor way that is spearheaded by Henry Lovejoy called Liberated Africans. And that website deals exactly with the courts that made the decisions on the ships that had been seized as to whether they were illegally enslaved people, and then they had to be dispersed in some way, either as laborers in the Caribbean or in special liberated African villages or settled in Sierra Leone. So there's a whole history there that the British story dominates because they were the main suppressing naval force on the sea, but that involves Brazil and Cuba. And I tell them the U.S. story, which is related, and I try to set my story within the broader diaspora of liberated Africans. So that's about the digital humanities and the legal status. But I also think that your point about Black unfreedom, Black mobility is very important because the conditions that recaptured Africans lived under, a kind of this legal limbo, this in-between space, was also related to the kind of suspicion and difficulties that legally free persons of African descent encountered in just traveling around the Atlantic, Europe, the Caribbean. There were these patchwork zones of freedom and unfreedom and all, everything in between.
Right. And that's why I think that, you know, defining terms, you know, it's very important. So I definitely appreciate that hold up that you did, because, you know, defining terms, you know, is very much important when you try to get students or listeners like we have on the channel here to really understand and know what these particular terms mean, because, you know, there are scholars that are still trying to define what in the heck unfreedom versus freedom actually is, especially in the context of laws. And so you see people like Martha Jones's work that's coming out later this year about race and rights in antebellum America. And so this is a very, you know, I think, and this is a cool part, is like, you know, there's so much work that's being put in right now that sometimes I met with people and they're like, I almost want to wait to put in my book proposals because there's something else coming out that I might need to work with, which I think is, I would say, you know, as someone who's unauthored, I would like to think that that's maybe a not exactly the worst problem to have. but
no, and in fact, this book took me, I'm embarrassed to say, 15 years, I would say, to write. And it started all the way back with a document that I encountered while I was actually doing my dissertation research. And then it sat in my mind and grew into this. But it, in that course of that time, all the digital search engines for newspapers and print culture came online. The databases, you know, about the slave trade came online, and then all of this literature that you're talking about. And I do have to give a shout out to Roseanne Adderley, who was one of the first people to really write a book length, and Monica Schuller as well, book length studies of liberated Africans in the Caribbean setting, and starting to explore some of those issues of a kind of in-between area of the medical crisis and the psychic crisis that liberated Africans were in their early times of resettlement, and all these questions of exile and homeland and identity in the Atlantic world. Roseanne Adderley's book, New Negroes from Africa, really talked about quite, I think it's a 2006 book, kind of set a standard for how we can talk about the human history of this, not just the ships and the courts and the traders. So that's one thing. And so I really benefited from having a historiography develop around me, in front of me. And as I was writing this, I had more and more literature to be able to contextualize my own primary research in.
And you're right. You know, the huge, huge work that's happening with print culture and with historic newspapers being added to online databases, you know, it just makes, you know, scholars like us, you know, really, really happy, because it allows us to be able to do work. You know, we can do work, you know, while chilling in our house with a cup of coffee at you know, well, for me, it would be 2 a.m, just sitting out, you know, chilling and just like going through hundreds of different newspapers, and not having to go to, you know, the standard archive, which is nothing wrong with that. And I definitely still push people to do that, but also understanding, like, you know, if, as money is dwindling in the academy, especially for students, you know, we have to be able to find, you know, innovative ways to be able to conduct the same work. And so digital archives definitely allow for that to happen. And it's great because it allows people to continue the work that they do and improve their work too over the course of time.
That's correct. And there is a small counter argument, I guess, you can make to that, although I think on the whole, it's a wonderful development. And that is that early on in this research, I would say sort of late 90s, early 2000s, when I was doing some of the newspaper work, I was in the UCLA room just grinding through the microfilm and making copies of all the things. And it was because I was looking at whole pages of newspapers that I was able to see some connections, especially when it came to Charleston, between things that weren't actual stories. They weren't actual stories on the Echo Recaptives, but they were ways that the Charleston citizens were responding to them as a form of entertainment. And I saw those things because I was looking at the whole sheet and scrolling through the newspaper. So maybe there's a little bit of that we miss when the algorithm or the search engine is feeding us the stories.
And so specific to your book, right? Something that I was very much interested in was, you know, charting the course of how really the, you know, how did America start to change its feeling if at all, even, you know, about recaptive Africans? Like, what was their, like, because what it seemed like from your book was like they were in a certain way, a very useful a political football for both sides, you know, the abolitionists, but also the pro-slavery element as well. Because you get to see people, right, by this time, effectively all of the people that are enslaved in the United States were born in the United States. And, you know, they ancestrally, right, down the line were obviously, you know, African in origin, but they didn't have much as far as personal experiences with Africans themselves, especially as the, specifically really as the 19th century pushes on into that 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s time frame. And I think that was, to me, one of the most important areas. So could you speak to that briefly, if you may?
Yes, absolutely. So first, I just want to make a short remark about the terms. My book is called Recaptured Africans. That was the term that was used in the United States. Elsewhere in the Atlantic world, especially in Britain and in the mixed commission courts, and of course, there were Portuguese and Spanish terms as well. But in English, the phrase was liberated Africans. That phrase, I did not see used much in the United States. And I think it was because it provoked the slavery controversy too much to talk about liberated Africans. And so recaptured Africans became for me it's also the word that was used, but it is a way to express the kind of unfreedom that this group of people still had. So, and then I use the word recaptives as a more modern version of recaptured Africans. So that's just for people to know where this term is used and probably why. And then how, I think you are really correct that they become a political football. It made me think of, well, this is a case you may remember, Elian Gonzalez, who was the young Cuban boy who came into my, and so on a mass scale, he was made a vehicle for all of these U.S. debates. And in this case, there are three different groups of people who have vested interests in the persons and bodies of recaptives. And that is one, an abolitionist perspective that might be represented by the New York Free Black activists I talk about. The other are the pro-slavery people situated especially in Charleston around the movement to reopen the slave trade that is concurrent to the ECHO recaptives actually being brought into the Charleston Harbor. And then the third are the colonizationists. And those are the either the moderate pro-slavery, moderate anti-slavery people who are also interested in colonization in Africa. And so all three of those groups are placing arguments and meaning upon what should happen to this group of, several hundreds of free captives who come into the U.S. in 1858 and 1860.
Right. And you know, that point that you made about, the potential reopening of the slave trade in the 1850s is something that's really such, I think that's one of the more intriguing areas of, 1850s discourse is that the South isn't booming. You know, they're making money. They're trying to expand, right? They're trying to go to Cuba, which apparently America has been trying to go into Cuba for a very long time. Along with going into places like Panama, Nicaragua, and other places in Central and South America. So seeing that, pro-slavery foreign policy, which worked like Matthew Carper involved in. And so it's very intriguing work. And so, you brought up even, what was the, reaction? You spoke about it briefly with the the print culture and reading the microfilm as seeing the different reactions from folks in South Carolina. But specifically, how did folks in the South, right? How did people, in the South, and also thinking about, federalism too, when it comes to the usage of the U.S. Navy in this work too. How did, you know, those factions coincide? And also how is there potentially any friction between them? Because they're not only a political football as far as their recaptive Africans, but their bodies could be used again, potentially, right?
Yes, right. So this pertains to chapter one and chapter two of the book, because what I seek to do at the heart of the book are this group of recaptives from four different ships, one that is seized by the U.S. Navy. All these ships are on their way to Cuba. They're fueled with American money, but they're on their way to the Cuban slave market. And they're intercepted by the U.S. Navy in 1858. The Echo is brought into the Charleston Harbor. And in 1860, the Wildfire, William and Bogota, are brought into the Key West. So one step backward that I would need to do is to situate what the law was at that time that then provoked these issues around federalism and ardent reactionary pro-slavery. So after the abolition of the slave trade by U.S. law, there was great debate about what to do if suspicious ships were seized and enslaved people were found aboard. And from 1807 until 1819, the federal government left it up to the states to decide what to do. And so even Du Bois writes about this as well in his book, that we have this enormous irony of liberated people who've been released from the holds of slave ships who are taken into southern states and then sold on the Southern auction to pay to, and the proceeds of the sales of their bodies go to pay the people who, the prize money for people who had captured the ships. And this, of course, is an enormous contradiction. And so by 1819, as the American Colonization Society had been formed for a couple of years by that time, they had a lot of influence in Congress. And they rewrite the law to say it will be that the recaptive Africans released from the holds of slave ships will go into the custody of U.S. Marshals. So they take it to the federal level, but they mandate a removal. This word removal is very interesting because it reflects the U.S. response, white response as a whole, to the distrust and suspicion of having free people of African descent in the United States. So the 1819 law mandates that the president, whoever's president at the time, will set the conditions to remove this group of people. They say the quote is beyond the limits of the United States. And that becomes Liberia. So by the time we get to the ships and the people that I'm talking about, there is a federal law that puts those recaptive Africans in the custody of the U.S. Marshal, and that mandates the U.S. government at the federal level find a way to put people on ships and send them to Liberia, where they are apprenticed to the Black American, the Americo-Liberian settlers there. So they take a new subordinate position, and that's toward the end of the book. And this is something in the context of the late 1850s with sectionalism, with secessionism, with all of the fervor over the Fugitive Slave Act, Kansas, Nebraska, all of this stuff is coming to a head. And the people, especially an individual that also Walter Johnson also writes about in his book when he's talking about pro-slavery empire, Leonidas Spratt, in Charleston, they want to use the 300 or so people of the young people, of the Echo, to repossess them in order to show the predominance of state law and states' rights over the federal government, and in order to kind of make real, manifest their claim that slavery is the best institution, the fitting institution for these recaptive men, women, and children. And so the way that they respond, both in the newspapers and in their actual and their court actions, is to try to get possession of this group of recaptives, but they are under federal guard at Fort Sumter. Now, I call this the first battle of Fort Sumter. And they are they are behind Marine Guard at Fort Sumter. And so there is just a real political struggle in the courts and in the court of public opinion through the newspapers and speeches.
Right. And I love what you said with that being the first battle of Fort Sumter, because, you know, most people think that Fort Sumter is just, you know, there's nothing going on there before the Civil War. But no, this book right here, Recaptured Africans, really says that nope, that's not the Paul Harvey story of, you know, the rest of the story that I grew up listening to from NPR. So shouts out to NPR. And so, you know, that is, I think, really interesting, because, you know, the fact that the Recaptured Africans are used in such a way, and also this is a time frame of, you know the dogger types, you know, the racial science that's so much emerging in this period too. You know, you have, you know, the dogger types come about, you know, about a decade earlier, but they're still, you know, rising. And so the how people conceive of who, you know, what enslavement looks like, and also what enslaved people look like as well, specific to what do Africans even look like, is all, you know, submerged within this area of time. And I think it's why sometimes when I think about enslavement and trying to think about, you know, what's my visual, you know, what's my visual memory of the institution, you know, from print culture and visual culture, you know, recaptured Africans rather, is really something that I've kind of seen my whole life. You know, it's almost like going by as an African American, going by a cotton plantation, and yet I've never picked a bill of cotton. But, you know, when I drove by one time, I, you know, everybody in the car froze. You know, and yet we never did, because it's the innate memory that's within you. Going further from that, you know, something that was also interesting too, you know, we mentioned offline about my family origins and where I grew up, was born and partially raised in South Florida, and realizing the importance of somewhere like Key West as well was something that was very intriguing to me, as far as the recaptive Africans that went through that particular within that particular, I guess, city or town. I'm not sure what was designated at the time, but within that particular area down in the very bottom of Florida.
That's right. And you know, that was just two summers later, in 1860. And Key West was really a crossroads of all kinds of Caribbean and U.S. and Gulf travel and maritime world. And, you know, it was a place that I think you there was a New Books interview with on Pensacola and on Roots to Freedom with Matthew Clavin. Is that right? Yeah. And, you know, Key West was like that as well, in that there were attempts by enslaved people in Key West to flee to the Bahamas, to flee into free areas of the British Caribbean by boat. So we have different kinds of freedom seeking and routes going on there. But in that summer, kind of late spring, with these three seized ships brought into Key West, there was also an Admiralty Court in Key West. And so suspicious ships could be determined to be, could be confiscated and declared to be prized ships. And then there was a group of people who the numbers, you know, I have these tables in my book, but the numbers are actually declining daily as you go along. But there are about 1,400 Africans seized on these three ships, and they're settled in a kind of a makeshift camp near the federal Fort Taylor, that's on the southern, kind of south western point of Key West. And they have to, all a makeshift hospital, doctors, and also, again, the press as a kind of a voyeurism that comes in to see they're set within the ethnography of the time and a lot of popular interest. And so you have this twin story of enormous suffering and death and alienation. And at the same time, there's a spectacle being made of recaptives in the popular press. And because illustrated newspapers had just come into being in the mid-50s, this is one of the Key West story especially was heavily illustrated. So people actually saw images as far away as California or New York or Wisconsin, saw images of the wildfire recaptives in Harper's Weekly. And I mentioned that I had begun this through curiosity about an original document that I had seen at the Virginia Historical Society that was a log of a Virginia physician who had been appointed as a U.S. agent to travel with the shipmates, the African recaptive shipmates of the wildfire who had been put on a second ship for Liberia. So, when I first saw that, I really just didn't even understand the context. That made me curious. But the next document that really cemented this as a story for me was seeing the Harper's Weekly full. It's a large illustration, about three quarters of a page, of all of the young people. And these are really, we haven't yet talked about the youth of the recaptives and what that meant for children and teenagers to be in this severe twice crossing the Atlantic in the midst of death, that kind of experience. But the wildfire then portrays that. And I think many listeners would actually, if they are interested in issues of slavery or the slave trade, have probably seen an online image of the wildfire, which is often used as a kind of generic depiction of Middle Passage. But that is historically inaccurate in that the daguerreotype was taken at the bottom of the engraving. It says it's from a daguerreotype, but I was unable to find that. I'm still interested in contacting Harper's and trying to see if we can find, is there an actual photograph behind that engraving? But that was taken as the wildfire was towed to the government wharf in Key West. And then, if indeed it was based on a daguerreotype, a photographer actually took that picture as these people in a state of severe emotional and physical crisis were displayed aboard the deck for them to document.
Right, and you spoke earlier about spectacle, right? The spectacle of slavery, the spectacle of capture. In large ways has been historical continuity when it comes to those of African descent going all the way through going from this period through the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement and really the lynching era as well, looking at how spectacles and even now with first person accounts on cell phones of death of African people, of those of African descent. And so what it shows is that there's a historical continuity there, which is profound. I would like to say it's very profound and unfortunate.
Yes, I really could not agree more. I do see the relevance of this story for white America's struggle to acknowledge the value of Black life and to, the fact that this, the fact of so many children also heightens the poignance of this experience. And in many ways, the racialization of these recaptives really did not allow observers to understand and to perceive children in the way that white childhood was being made sentimental and precious in the 19th century. And we, even though the press acknowledged the presence of youth, they did speak of it, but understanding how this illegal slave trade put in motion so many youth, it's tragic for the adults as well. I'm not belittling that, but really did not recognize this as a traffic in children in many ways. And I think this is something that the scholarship on liberated Africans Atlantic-wide, the whole diaspora of liberated Africans, is working still to understand what it meant in terms of responding to that kind of captivity and global displacement, and then what it meant for youth and young people to be able to rebuild their lives in these new settings of apprenticeship. So there was one in terms of spectacle, one of the phrases in Harper's really caught my attention, and I built some analysis around it in the book, and that they start by speaking of the suffering, but then there's a phrase where they say, notwithstanding their suffering, they're such an interesting sight. I'm kind of paraphrasing there, but there is a literal phrase, notwithstanding their suffering, and there's this pivot to how fascinating and exotic and interesting this group of people is. And I think that's that pivot and that racialization that diminishes the value, the full significance of the life and the life experiences of these recaptives.
I think one of the coolest parts, or excuse me, cool might not be the right word, but the most fascinating, rather, parts of the book was learning about, like you said, how many children, right? How many children were on, you know, the ships, and how scared, honestly, they must have been. And how, you know, how, and you spoke about the media earlier as well, about how the complicity of the media in, you know, some of these accounts, and also how they at times did try to mitigate, that as well. But, you know, the people that were really out front trying to really, work on behalf of the recaptives on the abolitionist side, you know, you spoke before about folks, the abolitionist community in New York, which I thought was so profound, because I think a lot of times we get enamored with folks in Philadelphia and from where I am in Boston, that, you know, every now and again, the folks in New York don't, I think, get enough just due. And folks like Pennington in New York, I think, is one of the more intriguing folks, especially because, hey, you know, he got a doctorate of honorary doctorate of divinity in was the University of Heidelberg or somewhere out there in Germany. So,
mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I think that Pennington was someone who was especially attuned to the crisis of recaptives as a whole, and of children in particular. You mentioned earlier about the racial science, and especially in the chapter on Charleston, that comes up. But there are many pro-slavery people who are arguing for this theory of polygenesis, of separate origins, that they're actually different human species. And one of the reasons why it was important for me to have the chapter, which is the fourth chapter, on the New York activists, and specifically focusing on James Pennington, is that I see in this engagement against the illegal slave trade and Pennington on behalf of recaptives, a kind of human rights discourse that's seeking to counter, a real counterpoint to that pro-slavery polygenesis type of rhetoric that's coming out of the South, especially the reactionary pro-slavery South. It's also a counter to the colonizationist discourse as well. But they are actually using the phrase, Pennington was giving their advertisements in newspapers for his lecture on human rights. And part of their human in the human rights had to do with the unity of the human species, and that all humans have these rights. So James Pennington, by virtue of being a former fugitive slave from Maryland. The Fugitive Blacksmith is his slave narrative. He had come to New York. He had really rebuilt his life. And, you know, I think that he understood what it was to be a young person. He escaped as he came of age. He was a very young man when he escaped and went through all the trials and tribulations of getting up to New York and Brooklyn. And so I think he understood what it was to be alone and hungry and scared and physically suffering and spiritually and psychically also in trauma. And so when he And he also had experience, we were talking about this offline as well, with the Amistad group in both through their trials, but especially when they were in Farmington, Connecticut, and awaiting and arranging their return to the Mende Coast area. And that was in around 1840, 39 to 41. So as a younger man, Pennington had experience with them. And so when the news about Key West comes into the newspaper, he responds with several letters, two letters to a white newspaper called The World that was just getting its start. It becomes important later on in journalistic history, but it's just getting its start in 1860. And he argues that really this whole slave trade suppression is a racket. And he says the Navy's making money, everybody's making money off the recaptives, but they aren't looking at them and thinking about justice for these people as displaced people. And what he argues for is apprenticing them briefly with free families in the North, kind of getting them back on their feet. And he has a Christianizing a mission idea behind this as well. And then figuring out a way to repatriate them to their own homes. Liberia was the home of none of this group. The recaptives who I talk about either come from West Central Africa, from the Congo region, or a little bit south from Luanda, or they come from West Africa in the region of either Benin, Dahomey, parts of Yoruba town. So they're west. No one is from Liberia. So this is not a homegoing, as some white government officials think it is. And Pennington knows this because he's a world traveler and he understands different geographies of Africa. So all of this, his life experience, causes him to weigh in and to call for justice and to call for a focus on the recaptives themselves. He also has experience with three boys who, in another kind of mind-boggling story, have stowed away on a slave ship that had landed in Cuba and offloaded its human cargo. And so these three boys had actually hid under some planks and only been found in Charleston when naval members were cleaning out the ship, getting ready to transfer it over as a prize ship. They then are brought to New York as potential witnesses against the crew, and Pennington goes to visit them in the jail. So there are boys who are between 8 and 12 years old, and they're being kept in a jail, and Pennington goes to visit them there and tries to communicate with them. So both in his newspaper editorializing and in his direct relationship with these young boys, he is involved in the illegal slave trade, in advocating on behalf of the people, of the human cost, of the victims, of the trade themselves.
And that's huge because Pennington is, like you said, he was a world traveler. And so because of that, he has the opportunity to truly understand the ramifications in ways that many other abolitionists, and definitely pro-slavery folks, didn't have, the depth of understanding that, and I think this goes to even how people talk about Africa in general for even much up until our present moment, where people think that, Africa is monolithic, right? Or even the thought of, Africa's actual size on geographical maps, right? And it has been shown like the actual scale of Africa on maps has actually been degraded over the course of time, which is interesting as well. And so, you know, like you said, like you have people coming from all, you know, so many different areas of on the African continent, you know, with totally different, you know, styles, religious practices, and just overall lifestyles. And yet you believe that taking them to Liberia, right, and designating them, as you call here, Congos, if I'm getting that correct, you know, is going to constitute them as like a home going, right? You know, we're bringing them back to their homeland, when in reality, they could not be anywhere further from where they are originally from. And so, you know, that part to me was the most important. And also, and can you speak to this as a particular question? Once people got to Liberia, right, what were their reactions, you know, over the course of time of the people who are more, I don't know how to really say, but the people that would be more constituted as native, not really native, right, but the people that in that had been there a certain amount of time prior to the recaptives, specific to your book, coming into the fray?
Right, right. Those are such important questions. So I want to just go back just for a minute to the issue of the diversity of Africa and the many origins of people who were enslaved. And in one of the central organizing principles in this book is that idea of the shipmate. And so within the history of the slave trade, many scholars have written about, from way back, have written about the importance of the shipmate bond, of people who may not even have been from the same hometowns or homelands, and may even have not been of the same language, but often that was the way people could bond, who form a bond through their experience through the Middle Passage. And later, people who are shipmates in all over the Americas sponsor each other in baptism, or they are godparents to others. So this shipmate bond is very important. So for me, I quickly realized that once, especially when there were multiple ships coming into Key West, they were actually put in shipmate groups onto ships. So you have a group of people who have traveled with each other, both in Middle Passage and then in Recaptive Passage, if we want to call it that. And so what this did was, so out of Key West, there are shipmate groups that are from West Central Africa, and there are shipmate groups from Ouida in Benin, who are called the Dahomeans, even though they weren't necessarily of that. Many of them were Yoruba. And so when they get into when they arrive in Liberia, the group from Ouida, from West Africa, many, many more adults in that group. Their demography was different. And so they had a different set of resources to draw upon. Interestingly, that group, the Bogota, who were from West Africa, were very closely aligned in history with the Clotilda, who Sylviane Diouf talks about, the slave ship that came into Mobile in Alabama, and that then established after emancipation Africa Town. They really passed through the Barracoons in Ouida around the same time, the people who I studied and the people who... So there's a difference. One ship was intercepted and they became recaptives. One ship was not and smuggled into the U.S. So these are these contingent destinies of people in the slave trade. But that group in Liberia actually resisted being separated and resisted the, there was a, some younger people out of that group were apprenticed. There was actually a conflict, a physical conflict where people were shot. And the president of Liberia, Stephen Benson, had to go and reassure that group. And they ended up insisting in being able to stay and live together. The group of people who were from West Central Africa, who really are responsible for recaptures being called Congos in Liberia at the time, were so many of them heavily youth, and they become apprenticed. So when you say, how do folks who are native respond to them. There are two other groups in Liberia who they are interacting with. One is the group of Black American settlers, so African American settlers who are sometimes called Americo-Liberians, who have established individual farms, and they're looking for labor. Some of them even have sugar plantations. Some of them have coffee plantations. And so the records of the U.S. agent for recaptured Africans actually shows the dispersal of hundreds of recaptives across Liberia in this period of between 1858 and especially 1860 and 1861. Famous people who we know from African American history, like Alexander Crummell, for example, talk about this and speak about it as the Congo inundation, because there were so many recaptives, not just from the U.S., from those camps, but also intercepted right off of the West Central African coast. So they were almost 6,000 who were brought into, I'm sorry, almost 5,000 brought into Liberia between 1858 and 1861. And so there's the tiny settler population who was apprenticing them. And then there are the indigenous groups of Liberia as well. And so I wasn't sure who you meant when you said, how do native threat, because there are the indigenous, Vai, Gola, et cetera, and then there are the Americo-Liberians who are the ones who are taking in these recaptives and attempting to convert them to Christianity, to educate them, to bring them into that particular culture of Americo-Liberian life.
Right, and thank you for that clarification, because, right, you know, It's interesting the use of the term indigenous, at least, you know, as someone who studies American history or is an Americanist, I guess it would be the more classic term. Typically, I hear that term being used, you know, in as far as like Native American groups. And so obviously, you know, it has a presence in the work of Africanists as well, and specific folks who are studying and intersecting in transnational works like yourself, dealing with folks like in Liberia who are indigenous to the land of Liberia. But thank you for that, because it's definitely an interesting, it's an intriguing juxtaposition as far as, you know, the national discourse in Liberia, because, you know, it's they declare independence within the time frame that you speak of, and so it's intriguing, because folks like Crummell and other folks like Delaney late around this period too, and other folks who are emigrationists who are pushing for those of African descent to not only come to areas in West Africa coinciding with Liberia, but also, you know, the Christianizing element that people like Sylvester Johnson speak about with their work on Christian colonialism. And so it's definitely something that's intriguing, that's really made me think about what, because some of my work is involved with anti-colonization and what, you know, what were the actual motives of those who were vying for African American emigration, and really, I think the part of your the overall scheme of your book, I think is remarkable, because it allows people to realize like what happened to the folks who were taken back, you know, to Africa, but also specific to the part of they're not going to where they originally were, you know, where they're actually from.
Right. That's right. And it's such a complicated history, because the way that Liberia gets colonized and then becomes independent, and these different groups and the political splits between those who arrive as immigrants or recaptives, and then those who are already on the land, indigenous, as I put it, those political splits erupt in the Liberian, they have legacies directly down into the Liberian civil wars of the 1990s.
Right. And one question I do have in the few minutes that we do have left, what was the because as you said, this is a very complex story and trying to weave everything together, you know, it's a lot. It's a big undertaking. So if you don't mind the question, what was the particular, was there a particular challenge that was the largest in this particular project, in creating this work?
Yes, that's very easy to answer. And it's the lack of first person testimony from the actual recaptives I speak about. There is that testimony through narratives published in Sierra Leone. Other people, other Africans who experienced this phenomenon of enslavement and recaptivity in the British system, who then published in English language narratives. But that's what I would have wished for, because people would appear in the records in very intriguing ways, in important ways, but then disappear. And so it was difficult to follow them. And it was also, I would love to have had their voices.
Right. And you know, that's why I think the recovery work that you conducted with your book, I thought was really profound, because, you know, there's always going to be something that you wish you had. You know, that as we spoke about offline, I'm beginning my PhD work soon, you know, and I think that's one of the areas that a lot of scholars have told me is like, there's always, or a lot of times, there's going to be something that you wish you had, but still doing, you know, but still weaving, you know, the thread of the story together, is still something that's important. And that importance is really seen with your book, Recaptured Africans. Because I think the work of really the larger works that deal with those of African descent, a lot of it is recovery work. A lot of it is using, you know, a lot of times there's scarcity of records, and being able to deploy different methodology to really put together this story, I think is one of the most profound things I see in a lot of works today. And your work is definitely within that mold as well. So I definitely appreciate you for it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I do look at it as a work of recuperation and hoping that, you know, I can put out there what I found, and then maybe someone coming along and find a new set of sources that will shed additional light. But just making this story visible, we place it along other kinds of stories, like the stories of the enslaved, the stories of free Black people in various areas of the Americas, the stories of the fugitive, the stories of the maroon. And now, you know, we're beginning to understand the stories of recaptured people as well.
Right. And you know, we all play a role, and we all have, you know, a certain amount of time on the earth to be able to conduct the work that we want. And so, you know, you're definitely your work is definitely in there and making a lot of great leaps, you know, in the scholarship of Middle Passage studies and also in the study of really the slave ship as well. Like I said, in the few minutes that we do have, if you don't mind, now that this work is published and out to the world, you know, what's next on the agenda for you?
Well, let's see. I have a lot of smaller things that are going on, and then trying to think about what's the next big project. I do some work with the Colored Conventions project that you are familiar with at the University of Delaware, the Digital Humanity.
Yes, I am.
And then I also have an essay that's coming out. So I'm just, you know, doing the finishing parts on that, on a volume on liberated Africans that comes out of a conference at York University that was looking at the entire diaspora of liberated Africans. And in that essay, I spent more time with the phenomenon of recaptive youth in Liberia running away from their apprenticeships, and the idea that some of them may have really understood themselves as still being in slavery. So that essay is kind of looking again at the Liberia end and looking more closely at the resistance of especially young people to their apprenticeship situations. So that there's that. I've been a contributor recently to the fifth edition of Through Women's Eyes, a women's history textbook, working through the proofs on the early chapters there. And then for a long-term project, I really have my question, but not my plan yet. And that is that I'm continuing to be interested in relationships in the 19th century between African Americans and West Central Africa. At the Asala conference last year, I was able to put together a panel and be on a panel of people who are all considering 19th century Black relations to Congo and the idea of Congo. And usually we start that history around the 1880s with William Shepherd and anti-colonial resistance to Leopold. But I think, you know, Pennington is also already engaged with Congo youth. And so I'm interested in that full span of from the period of slavery to the period of early colonization in Africa of that circuit, U.S., Americas, and Congo area.
Very good. Well, hey, you know, if you ever get another, you know, book length work anytime soon, you know, you know where to find me, and you know we'll be comrades in arms working with the Colored Conventions Project too. So I'm definitely looking forward to all of the work that you have on tap going forward in your career, and you know, I definitely am glad that you came on and, you know, that you were able to speak to not only myself, but to the wider audience as New Books in African American Studies, very, very valuable subscribers and listeners and future subscribers and listeners. And so thank you for your time. And once again, today we've had the opportunity, folks, to be able to listen to Dr. Charlotte Fett, Associate Professor of History at Occidental College in sunny Southern California, for her book, published in 2017 through our friends at the University of North Carolina Press. The name of the book, Recaptured Africans, Surviving Slave Ships, Detention, and Dislocation in the Final Years of the Slave Trade. And so, once again, thank you for your time. And until next time, New Books in African American Studies listeners, my name is Adam McNeil, your host.